On Theologically Thinking, Father Stephen Ritter begins a series studying the state of Orthodoxy in the U.S. and the world. In this first episode, he explores the historical background behind the apparent rivalry today between the Patriarchates of Constantinople and Moscow.
Dear friends, the Orthodox Church is that singular and unique entity that Jesus Christ established on earth as his body. There is no other ecclesial organization in existence that compares to the magnificence and utter profoundness found within its walls. The Church is the ark of salvation, the only means by which any human being, anywhere, at any time in all of history, was, is, and will be saved. Its doctrine is the doctrine of utter perfection, manifest through the lives of its holiest members and partaken of by all who wish to do so. That's right. The gifts of the Orthodox Church are the greatest gifts ever offered to mankind, and they are completely free. Nothing is earned, nothing is bought or paid for, and certainly nothing is deserved. The spiritual wisdom of the Church is manifest as the true wisdom of the ages, ascertained by each and every one of her members as the very inner life of the living God, revealed to us simply because he chose to do so, through the grace found in his divine energies, which is how he communicates with us. Throughout the world, and in history itself, in any religion, culture, or philosophy, grace, goodness, kindness, beauty, and love are present only because of the revelation of Jesus Christ given to us in his unique body, his very real and indivisible body, the Church. There is no greater glory in this lifetime that one can experience apart from being a member of this Church, and there was no greater glory in the history of humanity than when Jesus Christ, the second person of the Most Holy Trinity, became incarnate on earth, assumed that very nature of human beings so wounded by sin, and completely refreshed it with the brightness and radiance of his divinity. It's as if a huge enveloping blanket of grace was laid across the whole existence of mankind, something comforting, hopeful, and promising, that the questions of life, indeed life itself, received an answer. And yet, when we look around at the state of the Church today, when we shine the light of truthfulness on so many aspects of Church life in the world, both from an ecclesiastical point of view and from the normal interactions that we all experience, both clergy and people, in the local and oh-so-vital spiritual workshop of Orthodox parish life, it is not too hard to come away with a rather pessimistic, disappointed, and even faith-questioning attitude that increasingly seems diametrically opposite to the very notion of the Orthodox Church as the body of our Savior. In this series, we will examine some of these issues that we face, some rather large-scale and some seemingly esoteric and even innocuous, at least on first look. Nothing in the Church is unimportant, though often we do have this inevitable tendency to put the cart before the horse, or to strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Orthodox people are especially adept at this, and there is no doubt that many will both disagree and agree with some of the things said. This, in fact, is fine. We need conversations about these things, and without an honest assessment of the many and sundry issues facing us these days, we will get nowhere. It is important to realize that the viewpoints, prescriptions for change, and diagnoses that you will hear during the course of this series are entirely my own as an American convert priest who experiences the faith in this particular cultural milieu. No one put me up to them. There are no secret and hidden agendas lurking behind the man at the microphone, and there is no collaborative effort going on between myself and anyone else. If the truth is told, as it always must be, I have in fact been warned away several times by people I trust and respect to not engage in a series like this, or at least to be very careful as to what I say, the rationale being that once it's out there, it's really out there, and will follow me along unless I choose to publicly exonerate myself by recanting this, that, or the other. However, My share of our fallen human nature does not lead me at this point in life to be particularly careful about anything, and in fact I can assure all listeners that my motives in this are indeed pure. Having entered the church as a convert in 1979, been a lot of places, and seen far more than perhaps anyone should during the course of these 35 Orthodox years, my love for the church, warts and all, has only increased. But there have been a lot of ups and downs during this time, the main disappointment being the surety and prediction of the ascendancy of the Orthodox Church in this country, only to have that particular fantasy shot down several times in the most realistic of ways. Unfortunately, it is usually the Orthodox doing the shooting, and if there are problems, difficulties, and unfulfilled promises, the results from all of this have little to do with our Lord and a lot to do with us. One of the main premises of our failure to sufficiently propagate the faith in this country is our own failure to properly practice this faith, as we shall see further on. But even here, I do not anguish. If church issues, even those that might drive one to despair, plagued a luminary like St. Paul, right smack in the midst of the early apostolic age, can we, so far removed, expect any different? I hardly think so. The Galatians came under particular scrutiny, designated by the apostle as foolish and bewitched for not understanding the truth of the crucifixion and the consequent reliance on grace, while the apostle also bemoans the predilection of the Corinthians for sexual immorality, not even found among, heaven forbid, the Gentiles themselves. In both instances, the foibles of the modern faith have not seemed to improve much, as Orthodox in general seem to be as susceptible to these things as anyone else and at any time. But all of this is to point out that problems in the church are nothing to fall into despondency over, and in some respects are to be expected. But this does not mean that they are to be ignored either, and each generation must approach this task anew in order to confront the machinations of the evil one in its own time, always aware that the long ingrained habit of the devil's masquerading as a lion seeking to devour whomever he may is something that never changes, yet his wiles can be defeated by Christians of faith and purpose. There are in the world today 14 Orthodox bodies that can lay claim to an independent status from an ecclesiological standpoint. 15, if you speak to most members of the OCA, or Orthodox Church in America, and assessing the health of them is sort of like pushing down hard on a waterbed. Some parts of the mattress rise, others fall, and then it changes as quickly as you can see it. Overall, things look generally better than they did 50 years ago. At that time, most of the largest Orthodox churches were enslaved to a political system that was intent on either controlling or eradicating the faith, and sometimes both, in that order. The Slavic countries finally were freed from this burden, and there's been a discernible and notable improvement in church situations in Russia, Georgia, Bulgaria, and other eastern places like Romania, though the Serbian church has suffered much in the last 20 years. Fundamentalist Islam has reared its ugly head in the Middle East, and the churches of this area are in perhaps the most profound struggle for survival that they have ever encountered. It is estimated that the Christian presence in Jerusalem could well die diminished to almost nothing in the next 10 years, while the Venerable Patriarchate of Antioch is facing challenges of an unbelievably severe nature and may be entering into a period of extensive martyrdom. The Patriarchate of Alexandria, on the other hand, while much smaller in total numbers than Antioch, has enjoyed an unprecedented expansion of congregants due to its far-reaching missionary efforts in the last 20 years. But with its location being centered in Alexandria and Cairo, the future seems less secure with the recent advent of the so-called Arab Spring, even though its territory extends to the entire African continent. The fearful thought remains that the Middle East as we know it today could indeed experience a radical reworking of its own geographical map in the next few years, with Christian and other indigenous populations ending up shifted once again to regions unknown. If anything can be counted on, the biblical maxim that Orthodox Christianity lacks any homeland except the heavenly one has never been truer. But the world at large focuses on news reports and sound bites, and most people are familiar with mainly two Orthodox churches today, Constantinople and Moscow. There are antipathies between the two that date back hundreds of years, and recently have been exacerbated for reasons that many Orthodox consider silly and pointless, while others elevate the disputes to matters of the utmost importance, as if the faith itself depended on the outcome. Both are highly martyric churches, both susceptible to political influences, and, it must be admitted, to the degree of utter tiresomeness. Both are vying for influence and power on the world stage, each anxious to portray itself as the genuine Orthodox leader in the world. Each can, and to its own mind, has made the claim in several ways why preeminence should be accorded to it. But these claims are to a certain extent based on outdated and archaic visions of the church that are being pursued in a game of churchly historical catch-up that is hardly conducive to a vibrant and Christ-oriented vision of the modern world. In other words, the premises of this competition are not valid for the church today because they are simply too inward-looking. Now, before the cards, letters, and emails start pouring in no way do I mean to indicate that there is an absence of the Spirit of our Lord in either of these ecclesial bodies. Quite the opposite, in fact. Personally, I have met Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew and found him to be engaging, highly intelligent, very devout, and unswerving in his commitment to the Orthodox faith as the true Church of Christ. I have not had the honor of meeting Patriarch Kirill, but I know those that have, and some know him very well. No one has ever given me any impression other than he is also highly intelligent, a wonderful communicator, very devout, and committed to the Orthodox faith as the true Church of Christ. We are fortunate that both of these men are in office today. And there are other good and pious hierarchs heading up many of the other independent churches too. But as I said, the world populace at large concentrates on these two. So why is this? In the case of the Ecumenical Patriarch, he has the huge weight of history on his shoulders and a canonical mandate, or some would argue, though others dispute the relevance, from an ecumenical council, the second to be exact, which was the first held in Constantinople in the year 381. This council said in its third canon that the church there shall have primacy of honor after the Bishop of Rome because Constantinople is the new Rome. This effectively demoted the churches of Alexandria, which went into temporary schism over it, Antioch and Jerusalem, and Rome itself in the person of Pope St. Leo the Great during the time of the Fourth Ecumenical Council, declared that Canon 3 had never been submitted to his church, and balked at the idea of the term ecumenical as being applied to the patriarch, or any patriarch for that matter, a development which, in the light of subsequent history, smacks terribly of the proverbial pot and kettle, but that's another story. There was also argument as to the expansion of the boundaries of Constantinopolitan influence, something which is still being debated today. Because of this impressive pedigree and the fact that the local Orthodox churches do indeed see the patriarch as having a primacy of honor, though the degree of honor is hotly debated, and because it was the unfortunate head of this church that suffered the ignoble excommunication by Cardinal Humbert and the legates of the Pope of Rome in 1054, though he fired back with his own excommunications, and when people think of the great schism between East and West, now Orthodox Christianity and Roman Catholic Christianity, the man who appears in the popular press is inevitably the Patriarch of Constantinople as the representative of all the Eastern Orthodox churches. And he has a point in making claim to be just that, even though there are Orthodox congregations in the world with larger flocks than he has in his immediate territory, and for years he has been the Christian whipping boy of the hostile Turkish government, a position born with much humility and a deep understanding of the importance and significance of his see. For the Patriarch of Moscow, the story is entirely different. Though the Russian Church claims its beginnings in 988 with the conversion of St. Vladimir in what is now the independent country of Ukraine, the Patriarchate was not fashioned until 1589, and within less than 150 years it was abolished by Peter the Great, not to appear again until the fateful year of 1917, when the martyr St. Tikhon took the burden upon himself. So as the Russian Church is the newest, relatively speaking, of the international autocephalous Orthodox churches, its patriarchate can claim only a total of about 250 years of existence in all of Russian Orthodox history. Unusually, when the Church of Russia obtained a patriarch, they also received their autocephaly, or independence, by the ecumenical patriarchate, though there was some quarreling over being granted fifth-place status in the ranking of churches when they were initially promised third. But the fact that they were given such a high status to begin with, leapfrogging other more ancient churches, does in fact accord with Constantinople's own accession so many centuries earlier, because they were the capital of the empire. But the Russian Church existed in an empire also, a very large one, and no one argued that it should not enjoy such a placement among the worldwide churches because of its size and regal basis. But there are several things that argue for the preeminence of the Russian Orthodox Church today, according to many. One is the undeniable period of excessive and extreme martyrdom which this church endured in the 20th century. It has been claimed that there were more martyrs in the Russian Church during this period than in all of Orthodox Christianity in its whole history. While such a claim is hard to validate, the magnitude of its confession, coupled with so many stories of so many people and places suffering for the Lord that remain in living memory of a large number of Christians, certainly adds much gravitas to this severely tried church. Despite the many qualms one might have about the Russian Church today in several different aspects of its existence, due respect must be given to the fact that Orthodox Christian blood has been spilled in such copious quantities for her Savior. Another point in its favor is the sheer size of this church, easily dwarfing any other Orthodox church in the world today, and according to some statistics, larger than all the others combined. Is this not also a reason for preeminence, especially since the Patriarchate of Constantinople received its status for similar reasons having to do with position in the empire? Not so fast, say the proponents of the Fanar. There is no empire. There is no king anymore, though Russia was the last country to ditch absolute monarchy, and an ecumenical council appointed Constantinople to its present position, and as we all know, Orthodox do not tamper with ecumenical councils. So if any changes can be made, and we haven't yet decided if they can be, then they have to be made by an ecumenical council. But the Russians argue that circumstances in church life change, and accommodations need to be made in regard to certain things to better reflect contemporary realities. Besides, they say, we are in a better position to lead in the modern world, while the Patriarch of Constantinople flounders away in a hopelessly futile political position, barely able to function independently. Well, you get the idea. Of course, these are oversimplifications, sort of, and learned and obtuse papers have been produced defending both positions. Moscow, though obviously the larger power player in all of this, is highly unlikely to take its toys and go home, boldly asserting leadership in the Orthodox Church de facto while moving ahead behemoth-like, because it too knows, and knows very well, of the venerable status of the ecumenical patriarchate, and even if it did try to forge its own way, the other autocephalous churches would surely not go along with it, creating a serious situation where the largest Orthodox church in the world could possibly no longer be called Orthodox at all. But it is a mistake to assume that all of this posturing on the part of Moscow is simply for show or vying for leadership in the Orthodox world as an end in itself. It is also profoundly concerned about the state of Orthodoxy in the world today, and only benefits itself as a working and functional member of the worldwide body of churches. Constantinople, for its part, though holding a lot of the cards and actively challenging Russian hegemony in a number of disputed church situations all over the world, is also bound to a large extent by the play nice rule, in that it knows for a surety that it cannot act in any significant way on a host of issues without support from Moscow. Already, its diminished size causes a lot of self-esteem issues, and the almost incessant and sometimes blatantly obvious ploys to attract international attention are redolent of a child trying desperately to be someone in the midst of a large family. Monikers like Spiritual Leader of the World's 300 Million Orthodox Christians or the Green Patriarch have more the feel of a publicity department than of something actually integral to Orthodox Christianity. Yet, Patriarch Bartholomew himself is such a dignified man and comes across with genuine sincerity that one has to reassess whether the monikers are indeed heartfelt and in some sense very true. Neither is Patriarch Kirill, free of some publicity shackles. While he has avoided some of the more egregious appellations of his beleaguered counterpart in the Fanar, he is saddled with what many people, especially in the United States, consider even more significant, the Russian state itself. While there is no doubt that some of this is a byproduct of Cold War hyperthermia, and that Americans in general of a certain age still get the shivers when considering anything having to do with Russia, especially when some of its present actions remind them of the not-too-long-ago Soviet antics perpetrated all around the world to the detriment, and often death, of many, the seemingly age-old question of church-state interactions are reaching such a fevered point that many wonder if speaking of the Russian state and speaking of the church are not one and the same thing. There are in this country many Orthodox who despise Vladimir Putin, seeing him as a czar in waiting and definitely a czar in wanting, while others see him as a moral compass almost unequaled in our time. And Patriarch Kirill has appeared to agree with and support him in many things. Then again, if Putin is spouting morally correct positions, even if they are insincere, what is the Patriarch supposed to do? Oppose the obviously correct and orthodox point of view because of who is saying it? Yet there are some Orthodox who believe that supporting Putin is a criterion of orthodoxy itself, and that criticizing him places one somehow in a suspicious light. This only goes to show the still unresolved and highly charged intricacies of church-state relations in Orthodox theory and the plight of two different patriarchs. One is a prisoner of a system that has killed and transferred populations of Orthodox Christians for many years and whose ability to act is based on a very clever and cautious playing of the political game for the sake of mere functionality. Constantinople, while the other is a prisoner of a system that has killed and transferred populations of Orthodox Christians for many years, and whose ability to act is based on a very clever and cautious playing of the political game for the sake of mere functionality. Moscow. Wait a moment. Did I just repeat myself? In fact, if one examines what each of these men is faced with, there are indeed similarities, even though the political realities and skillful maneuvering required are of a different nature. Underneath, there are many parallels. Perhaps this is why the two men seem to get along so well when together. Each knows the fragile nature of what each wishes to accomplish, how dependent they are on outside forces that may or may not be acting according to genuine conviction, and each wants to help grow their respective churches and make things better for their flocks, which, I might add, according to a number of statements made by both, are seen as encompassing the whole world. This last point is something that is becoming increasingly important in our days. For the first time in history, and largely because of history, we have churches that are taking an interest in what is happening beyond their own borders. Now, it is true that the reason for this is because their own people are finding themselves outside of the normal purview and boundaries of these churches. Hence, the Patriarch of Constantinople travels to Finland in order to celebrate the 90th anniversary of its autonomy. And the Patriarch of Moscow makes statements about the worldwide nature of its mission today, especially as so many Russians were scattered at the time of the revolution and have stayed put since then. And they are not alone. Almost every church that can muster this means to do so has tried to expand in areas wildly divergent from its primary geographical focus. Immigration causes this, but so does, let's face it, money. Especially here in the United States, it seems that so many churches want as big a piece of the American pie as they can get. After all, once the Russian Revolution essentially destroyed the idea of any normal ecclesiastical life in this country, our great melting pot became the target of every Orthodox church out there, resulting in a situation that is far from anything one might consider normal. We are not alone in this, however. Many other traditionally non-Orthodox countries, like Australia, Britain, even places in the South American hemisphere, have experienced the same thing, and the mess will take quite a lot of sweeping before it gets cleaned up. All this leads to what I believe is the besetting problem facing the Orthodox world. Our usual nationalistic church schemas are failing us. In times gone by, particularly in times of empire, this seemed to work because there was no pressing need for constant and thorough interaction among the various church bodies. When a local dispute arose, often Patriarch A would summon Patriarchs B and C to come help solve a problem that B was not even aware existed. The identity of a nation was often absorbed directly from its Orthodox faith, and the dictum of St. Ignatius of Antioch, which said, "Where the bishop is, let the people be gathered around him," served as the core principle of ecclesiastical existence. This is still the case today, though a lot has built up around this foundational principle, and sometimes we have to dig deep in order to discover that it does still remain. Yet times change, as does the world. And primarily because of that beast we know as technology, it, more than anything, is redefining life as we know it for all people everywhere. This is not the place to argue the pros and cons of such a development. Suffice it to say that it is here to stay, and we ignore it at our peril. It is only going to continue in a manner that will make the last 100 years look like the turtle racing the hare. Our church interactions and the way we do business must adapt to this new reality, not as some kind of updating, for our theology remains the same, sin is the same, and the Orthodox prescription for combating it remains the same, but we must change in terms of how we adjust ourselves to this world of lightning-fast communication, and also how we present the truths of the faith when so many issues are demanding an Orthodox response, and far too often not getting it.
You've been listening to Theologically Thinking with Father Stephen Ritter. This has been a production of the Orthodox Christian Network.